In a time of fake news, fake politicians, and fake fiat currency, it's getting harder to find the genuine article. That's why when it comes to precious metals, I call the team I can trust. This is David Knight for my friends at Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange. Proudly veteran-owned and operated, Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange is your home for gold and silver coins, bullion, jewelry, and more. Prices and inventory are updated daily, so you get the most competitive possible pricing. And when it's time to sell your gold and silver items, they pay top dollar. Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange also accepts and deals in Bitcoin. Call or text the owner, Tony Arterburn, today at 888-667-1836. That's 888-667-1836. Or just go to wisewolf.gold. From bullion to Bitcoin, Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange.
Wise Wolf Gold and Silver Exchange.
Veteran of three foreign wars, entrepreneur, and warrior poet, Tony Arterburn takes on the issues facing our country, civilization, and planet. This is the Arterburn Radio Transmission.
Understand what I'm talking about? What is our common bond truly? Freedom. Freedom. Without freedom, you can't be a Christian no matter what denomination you belong to. You can't be a Buddhist. You can't own a donut shop. You can't drive from here to Oregon. You can't be an American because that's what it's all about, and that's the only thing that it's all about. Nothing else. Nothing else. It's about freedom.
On Tuesday, September 11th, 1990, the 41st President of the United States, George H.W. Bush, went before a joint session of Congress where he told the American people and the world three times that we are going to embark on a new world order because of a border dispute in what was formerly Babylon. 11 years to the day, almost to the minute, the son, George W. Bush, would be telling the American people and the world about a continued crusade in the same area because of cataclysmic terror on American soil. There are many mysteries to 9/11, both metaphysical and material. Now, we're going to explore some of the great research today of James Perloff, who has spent his life looking into conspiracy research, looking into alternative history, the real facts. We're going to talk about that. And there's lots of outlandish theories about 9/11, but none so outlandish and unbelievable as the official story. So I want to welcome to the Arterburn Radio Transmission my good friend, friend of the show, James Perloff. You have to know who James Perloff is, folks. Truth is a Lonely Warrior. One of his masterful books, The Shadows of Power. I love 13 Pieces of the Jigsaw. I've got that behind me on my bookshelf as well. And we've had James on the show at least twice. And we talked about false flags before. I booked him about 6 months in advance, knowing that we were going to be on the air leading up to the 20th anniversary of 9/11. So welcome to the show, James Perloff.
Well, Tony, thank you very much. Appreciate the good work that you're doing. And I think you're very fortunate to have a wife who acts as, I don't know if she's your producer officially, but she certainly seems to set things up well.
She does. She does a great job, helps me out and book guests because, you know, this is not my full-time job, but I'm dedicated to uncovering truths and doing research and and following in your footsteps, sir. So really appreciate the kind words. So let's jump right into this, James. I mean, tomorrow's the 20th anniversary of 9/11. And, you know, the official story goes something like this. 19 Arab hijackers somehow came across a copy of the Constitution in a cave in the Middle East somewhere or in Afghanistan and went berserk because they hate us for our freedom. They were sponsored by basically no state sponsors, nobody except this lone nut, Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda network. They were, you know, able to fly planes at altitudes and speeds that many pilots say are impossible. They were able to hijack aircraft with Donald Rumsfeld would say with plastic knives. And of course, you know, defy NORAD, all these masterful things that these 19 supposed hijackers did, right? And so that's the official story, and we should shut up. If we don't bow down to that, then we're somehow with the terrorists, and that's how it went. And my own personal life, you know, I was part of the first army company on the ground in Kandahar, Afghanistan, in the response to 9/11. And so I have a personal experience there, and I saw what was on the ground, and I saw what was being talked about, and talked to some of the people, even in the intelligence community, in real time. But this is 20 years later. We've had a lot to uncover. We've had, you know, the leak about the CIA meeting with bin Laden in July in Dubai when he was getting kidney treatment. There's pretty detailed evidence to show that they knew Osama bin Laden was in Pakistan on 9/10 of 2001, also getting dialysis and so many oddities. There's insider trading, all this other, you know, the peripheral stuff that we talk about that doesn't add up. But let's just dive into, you know, where should we start if we're looking at 9/11, putting it in context of an hour of radio? Where do you pick up?
Well, that's really hard to do in an hour. I had been working on a book on 9/11 for several months when the COVID crisis struck in March of 2020. And I'd actually written rough drafts of 16 chapters and still had plenty of chapters to go. Because I'd written posts on 9/11, and some of them were rightfully criticized for being too speculative. But I found that sometimes you have to speculate in order to get at the truth. You have to try out different ideas, just like Thomas Edison. You know, he had to try out different ways of making the light bulb work before he got it to work. And I know there's people who say that he didn't really invent the light bulb, but you do need to speculate to a certain extent. But I felt that for this book, I wanted to take the attitude that's expressed in the movie 12 Angry Men. If you've ever seen that, it's a movie about a jury that is voting 11-1 guilty. But as they look at the evidence, the real evidence, they objectively change their minds and they overcome their prejudices and they reverse their verdict. And I've had to do that before. I had to do on the Lindbergh kidnapping. And when I said, you know, I write this book, I'm not going to be speculative. I'm going to stick to things that I strictly know are true. And I'm going to be open to everyone. So I read just about everything I could. I read David Ray Griffin, Kevin Ryan, Judy Wood, Architects and Engineers for 9/11 Truth, Webster Tarpley. In fact, the last thing I was reading before the COVID crisis hit, which switched my attention totally, because this was the big real push for the New World Order, was the 9/11 Commission Report. I said, you know, I'm not going to criticize the 9/11 Commission Report if I haven't actually read it. I want to read it. I want to read everything that's out there on 9/11 before I write a book myself about it. And had about 1,000 pages of research accumulated. And I wanted to be very fair. I wanted to be very open to anyone who had something reasonable to say about 9/11. I did not want to shut out someone as a enemy agent or an infiltrator simply because they had a differing point of view. I wanted to hear all the viewpoints and be kind of like a jury or a courtroom and equally hear the prosecution and the defense. That was my attitude. What I wanted to talk about today, you know, there's a lot of theories about how the towers came down. As you know, there's besides the government theory, there's directed energy weapons, there's nukes, and there's thermite or nanothermite. And as far as the planes go, there's a lot of theories about the planes besides the government theory. There's the drone theory and the remote control theory and the theory that there were no planes at all, but just holograms or CGI that was added after the effect. And there are a great many people who adhere to all of these theories. And so I, with 1 hour limit, I did not want to get into debating these particular theories, but instead what I wanted to focus on today were four areas of evidence that definitely prove the government's theory is wrong. And I think that that's okay. A good starting place for people, especially who are new to 9/11. And if we had a second hour, which we don't, we could get into some of the controversies about the hows. But right now I want to stick to the definite things that discredit what the U.S. government said.
Okay. I mean, where I start usually to tell people is, you know, you're talking about New York City, mm-hmm. and you've got three buildings collapsing into their own footprint, and there's two planes. So we can start with that. And of course, the office fires causing skyscrapers to collapse into their own footprint has never happened before or since. These are places to start with people who have consumed the mainstream media, Mockingbird media narrative.
Right. So let's start with the Twin Towers, and then we'll go to Building 7, we'll talk about,
where do you start,
about the planes. I'm sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, okay.
That's great. Let's start there.
Okay. So if you look at the Twin Towers, they contained 90,000 tons of concrete. They had a combined weight of over a million tons. And physicists estimated that the rubble left behind should have been about 12 stories high. But if you actually look at the footage from 9/11, from that day when the smoke cleared, there were no 12 stories of rubble. In fact, all you saw were some pieces of steel sticking out of the ground. There was some rubble, but certainly nothing approaching what physicists say should have been there. The towers basically turned into dust. And this included not only 90,000 tons of concrete, which should have fallen as rubble, but instead turned to dust. There were 6 acres of marble in the Twin Towers that all turned to dust. Both towers had 47 vertical steel columns in the center, and those vanished. They just completely vanished. None of the furniture, not a single piece of furniture survived the so-called collapse of the Twin Towers. There were no toilets that survived, no computers, no phones. There were pieces of paper, you know, and there were some paper dialing pads from telephones that flew out, and those survived, but no telephones actually survived. And there were 10,000 metal filing cabinets in the Twin Towers, and not a single one survived except one from the basement, and that was crumpled up like a piece of aluminum foil. This did not make any sense. Also, no bodies were ever found of the people that were in the Twin Towers. The only bodies found were those of people who jumped before the collapses. I should mention that, yes, they did find bits of human flesh. They found, you know, little bits of bone and tissue, which is, some of which was analyzed and by a variety of DNA analysis companies, which were able to match it to people who had been in the Twin Towers. And I'm not going to dispute that. But the fact that there was no surviving material for the Twin Towers is completely inconsistent with other building collapses. If you just look at the recent condo collapse in Florida, for days they were digging bodies out of the debris. So why were there never any bodies found from the Twin Towers? That doesn't really make any sense. And there's something else that I should mention, which I think is pretty important, which is that there were, the Twin Towers were built with these external steel panels which fit together with like Legos, and they weighed multiple tons each. And they were actually photographed flying laterally, and they've been clocked at 70, as high as 70 miles an hour, and flying for several hundred feet. And, you know, to throw something that weighs several tons, 70 miles an hour for several hundred feet, that requires explosive force. You can't, that's not gravity. Gravity would mean that the panels should have simply come straight down, but they didn't on 9/11. So this was the collapse of the Twin Towers, like something that we've never seen before in history. It was not something that the 9/11 Commission cared to address, but it's kind of the first clue that the buildings exploded. The buildings definitely exploded. They did not simply collapse, as the government has always said. That's kind of the first of the four areas of evidence that I would mention.
Right, and as you finish up the one of the first areas, I was thinking, as you're talking about, you know, the concrete, no desks, no computers, no bodies, but they found the hijacker's passport.
Yeah,
this is the absurdity of the official story that you're supposed to believe. And that's a true. I mean, it's, you know, found by an FBI agent, right? So,
turned in by an unknown person, but the place was crawling with Mossad agents, in New York City on 9/11, and they were very, of course, as we know, they were very eager to pin this on Osama bin Laden, and the man who announced the discovery of that passport was the police commissioner Bernard Kerik, who later did jail time and had just gotten back from a trip to Israel. And, you know, he arranged for a very big loan in Israel from an Israeli businessman. So that whole story of the hijacker passport is one of the most fishy ones of this whole narrative. And the fact that none of the content of the Twin Towers could survive, but a hijacker passport could survive unscathed, you know, really unburned even. It didn't make any sense.
Absolutely unbelievable.
Well, the second area of evidence relates to, of course, to Building 7, which is where a lot of people start. Building 7 was the Salomon Brothers building. It housed the SEC and the New York headquarters of the CIA, as well as Mayor Giuliani's emergency center. And that building collapsed on the afternoon of 9/11 in 6.6 seconds. It was a 47-story steel frame building. And if you look at this, it really doesn't make any sense. I remember, if you go back to around 2005, the original defenders of the government narrative were saying that, well, you know, debris from the Twin Towers must have hit the Building 7, and they damaged the columns. There were 81 upright columns holding this building up. And they said, well, that's why the building collapsed. It was damaged by debris from the collapse of the towers. But that doesn't make any sense, because any debris would have only hit the front facade of Building 7 that faced the towers. It would not have hit the columns in back or in the middle. And scientists have examined the collapse of Building 7, which is visible in many, many, as you know, videos. There are many, many shots of it coming down. And they found that the building actually increases in speed as it comes down. Now, this isn't consistency. It's consistent with the laws of gravity. If you take a ball and drop it from a building, it will increase in speed. It will keep getting faster as it goes down. Wreckage of Building 7 actually increased in speed as it came down, meaning that there was no support of any kind. 81 steel columns had to give way simultaneously. Now, the 9/11 Commission never addressed Building 7 at all. Eventually, NIST did address it. That is the National Institute of Standards and Technology. And they said that that it was caused by fires from office furnishings. Well, there were 47 stories, and only six of those stories had any office furnishings on fire. That's really not going to make a building collapse at the speed of gravity. I agree that there were fires in Building 7. You can see the footage of it, and some of those fires were pluming out the windows. No question that there were fires, but you have to ask yourself, you know, the government says that the Twin Towers collapsed from planes and jet fuel, yet no plane hit Building 7. How do we account for these fires causing this very important building to collapse in less than 7 seconds? A very important building, considering that it covered the SEC, which was investigating Enron at the time, and the CIA headquarters. And, you know, why did this building come down in the amount of time that it did? This is something, by the way, that in 2017, a study by the University of Alaska said that it was impossible to have come down from office furnishing fires. That there, it had to be something else. Obviously, it was controlled demolition that brought it down. It looks exactly like controlled demolition, if you've ever watched the building that's been demolished. So that is kind of reason number two to doubt the official government story, that both the Twin Towers and Building 7 came down in manners that no other buildings in history have ever duplicated.
Now, some of the anomalies, too, like the on Building 7, you have the BBC reporter. I don't know if you've ever looked into this. The BBC reporter, yes, who reported that Building 7 had collapsed, and you can see it over her shoulder.
Jane Stanley.
That's an oddity.
Yeah.
Yes, yeah. Very much. Yeah. And of course, the University of Alaska Fairbanks, have you looked into that, James, that their research on
That's what I was just mentioning, that it was impossible that the buildings came down from office furnishings.
Yes.
And so we do have academic support for what we're saying. Of course, Architects and Engineers has thousands of members who are building designers and architects who have disagreed officially and signed statements that the government narrative is false. And the public was not been told this, you know.
And that was also, you know, housed the command center, like emergency command center for New York City, for Rudy Giuliani. And of course, it had, as you mentioned, you know, they had the FBI, SEC, IRS, Central Intelligence Agency had ties to the building. Just so many circumstances surrounding it. And of course, you just have to say, you know, three buildings, two planes, and then, you know, show people that video of Building 7 collapsing into its own footprint. And most people never got to see that. It was never shown. And like you mentioned, it was not part of the 9/11 commission. I'll back up real quick. I know that you're doing so much research on this, and I know we're limited on time, but when you looked into, when you're looking into 9/11, and I remember Jim Mars talking about this, the budget for the research on the 9/11 commission, wasn't it just very sparse? It was like almost nothing. I mean, even the 9/11 families were shocked at how little it was to start. Do you know anything about how much they spent?
I forget the ratio, but it was a tiny percentage of the amount of money spent on Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky. Right. That investigation.
It was like 13 million. Mm-hmm. It was some insanely small number for that big of an event. And I think George W. Bush spent like $30 million on his inaugural. So I just wanted to see if you'd looked into verifying those numbers. I've searched around. It's hard to get that info.
Yeah. There are other anomalies as well, by the way, the Building 7. One is, of course, from Barry Jennings, who was an emergency coordinator for the New York Housing Authority. On the morning of 9/11, he was descending the stairs of Building 7 with New York City attorney named Hess. They were coming down the stairs, and a tremendous explosion occurred beneath them, which actually tore out the stairwell beneath them, and they had to retreat upstairs. It was extremely hot inside the building, and Barry Jennings had to throw a chair through a window, and they were calling out the window for help. And you can actually see footage of Hess yelling out the window for help. I assume it's still up there somewhere on YouTube. You know, why explosions in Building 7? It was not hit by an airplane. It doesn't even begin to make sense. there was so much happening that day that is not consistent with what the government said or what the government bothered to investigate.
No, and you also have the testimony of firefighters that were there and completely ignored by the mainstream, saying, you know, we heard explosions, and it was multiple firefighters, multiple. And so, you know, we've never had a true investigation into 9/11 in these. You talk about NIST earlier and Building 7. What a joke. You know, just what an absolute joke. And I mean, it's only because of researchers like you that we're getting closer and closer to the absolute truth. And I'm so glad to have you here. I mean, this is just a historic time, you know, coming up on 20 years and what we're going through right now, James, which I won't get into on this show. We got lots to talk about in the second half. And James, we're going to cover, you know, at least two more points, and hopefully we'll have a little bit more time, you know, to go over this huge event. And I want to thank you for being here. We've got about 2 minutes until the break, and talk a little bit about your book as we go to the break, and what your plans are, when you plan to release it, and how people can get a hold of it once you do.
Well, it may be never. This was a huge book. You know, I totally stopped it when Trump shut down the country on Friday the 13th in March of 2020. And I worked flat out to produce this book. Your video listeners can see it. It's COVID-19 and the Agendas to Come Red Pilled. It sold over 10,000 copies in paperback. It was a top seller, number one in respiratory diseases on Amazon. And it was rated 5 stars on Amazon by customers. Thank you. But Amazon banned it after 2 months, but I was ready for that. I already had my own separate printing ready. So I hired my own distributor, I gave away thousands of electronic copies for free. I have it available in Mobi, EPUB, and PDF format, everything backed up with EndNotes so that people can see that everything is validated. By the way, I was a 45-year registered nurse in Massachusetts, so I'm medically somewhat qualified. And I know that you don't quarantine healthy people. We've never done that in history. I knew that this was the New World Order's big push. And so I decided that as important as 9/11 was, it was more important to switch to 9/11. I do have I had to switch websites because my website was under attack. So instead of jamesperloff.com, I'm now jamesperloff.net. And I do have a new post up. It's called COVID Visuals. It's very short videos, 1 or 2 minutes long, some 5 or 8. But I know that people today don't like to watch long videos, but a lot of people don't like to read either. And I said, well, the best thing is to get some really short videos from scientists and doctors, medical doctors, and victims of the vaccines and people who have disproven the PCR test, emergency room nurses, et cetera. And let people hear for themselves. So I'm trying to get as much evidence as I can.
I'm going to go to a hard break, James. My guest is James Perloff, jamesperloff.net. We'll be right back talking about 9/11.
Thanks.
Welcome back. This is the Arterburn Radio Transmission. I'm your host, Tony Arterburn. I'm joined with the great James Perloff of jamesperloff.net. He's the author of Truth is a Lonely Warrior, The Shadows of Power. This is the groundbreaking work on the research on the Council on Foreign Relations, 13 Pieces of the Jigsaw. And of course, we were just discussing in the first half of the show his book on COVID-19, Red Pilled, and the Agendas to Come. I own a copy. That's what he was saying thank you for. I was holding that up. I don't miss anything. If James Perloff is putting it out, I'm going to buy it. James, I'm so glad to have you here. And tomorrow is the 20th anniversary of 9/11. You know, you've broken down the first two of your 4 major points to just completely do a controlled demolition of the government's narrative. And I so appreciate that. Let's dive right back in because we are, you know, limited on time.
Sure.
But what's the third pillar that you start with when you're laying this out?
The speed and accuracy of the plane hits. Now, the most photographed plane hit on 9/11, or alleged plane hit, was Flight 175, the second plane hitting the South Tower. Now, if you look on Wikipedia, it says, according to the FAA, that plane was going at 586 miles per hour. Now, according to Boeing, the max operating speed for a Boeing 767 at that altitude is 425 miles per hour. Now, I'm not saying that the plane couldn't attain that speed. There are a couple of reasons. One is that I've been in close touch with a Airbus captain who tells me that when they test an Airbus, they bring it up to 500 miles an hour. It can withstand those speeds. They just want to make sure that it can. As far as could it get up to 586? Well, there's one thing to remember, which is that if you accept the government's story, the plane had come out of a very steep dive. And there's the factor of gravity. You know, there was a plane in 1987. It was flight 1770-71 Southwest. And it was actually was a suicide hijacking. It was hijacked by a disgruntled former employee of Southwest. He shot the two pilots. He then took the plane and he dove it into the ground. And when it hit the ground, it was going at a good 700 miles per hour. And some people would say, well, look, there's no way a plane could do 700. But when you add gravity to a full throttle, you could get up to that speed. So I'm going to say maybe it could do 586. I know that pilots for 9/11 Truth have got videos showing that the plane breaks up before it hits the Twin Towers. But for 12 or 15 seconds after coming out of a dive, maybe it could sustain the plane's integrity. I don't know. So I'm not going to really dispute that. But here's what I am going to dispute. The planes, all three planes hit with bullseye accuracy that day. Now, the day after 9/11, there was a chief pilot for his airlines named Dan Gavados. And he was the guy who would check all his pilots for their competency on simulators, and which pilots have to do. They have to keep recertifying. I'm a registered nurse. You have to recertify. You know, you have to prove your education has been upkept and things like that when you're professional. So he put 10 pilots or about 10 pilots in a simulator. And he said, hey, guys, you know, nobody could fly the day after 9/11. Everything was grounded. So he said, hey, guys, we've got nothing to do today. So let's see if we can hit the Twin Towers. And guess what? None of those 10 pilots could hit the Twin Towers. And these were guys who had tens of thousands of hours of experience flying Boeings. And so wow. The question becomes, how does a hijacker who's never been in a Boeing in his life, which according to what we know about Ada El-Shehi, Jara, and Hanjour, the four alleged pilots, none of them had ever been on a Boeing in their lives. How did they make bullseye hits when experienced Boeing pilots couldn't do it? And by the way, I should mention that, to be complete, Dan Gavados, the chief pilot, did hit the Twin Towers on his attempt, the final attempt. But even on his simulator, the simulator froze up around the mid 400s because you're not supposed to bring a plane up that fast. So how does a hijacker do it at 586? You know, imagine going down a highway at 100 miles an hour. That's so fast. How can you get a plane going at almost 600 miles an hour and hit with bullseye accuracy? Am I saying it's impossible? No, but it seems unlikely. And if you move over to the Pentagon, we're talking about Hani Hanjour, who attempted to rent a Cessna at Medway Airport in Maryland the month before 9/11, and they didn't trust him, so they took him up in the air. They found he had difficulty controlling it at 75 miles an hour. This is a little 20 engine right. Cessna. So yeah. How does he climb into a Boeing for the first time in his life, and at seven times that speed, he makes a perfect hit on the first floor of the Pentagon, not the second floor, not the third floor. That's a very narrow target. He did it with such perfection that his engines, which are below the wing, didn't even touch the ground. The ground in front of the Pentagon was pristine. Right. He didn't hit the ground. Now, there was some debris, some minor debris to the left, which people have come up with different reasons for, but how do all these pilots who have never flown Boeings before all make perfect hits on 9/11? I do want to mention, and for the sake of fairness, that El-Shehi, the pilot of 175, the second Twin Towers plane, and Muhammad Atta had done considerable flight simulator time, but they could not have attempted to hit the Twin Towers on their simulators, because when you when you're a student in a simulator, you have to be under the supervision of a pilot, and the pilot's not going to let you hit the Twin Towers, not unless he's a CIA agent who's in on the plot, which is possible, but it seems extremely unlikely that these pilots could have hit their targets at these speeds with these accuracies. And I want to point out one additional thing about this. If the Twin Towers were demolished, which we've produced some evidence early in this show that they were demolished, nothing was left. Nothing was left. Not the concrete, not the marble. Nothing was left. Not the furniture, not the bodies. If they were demolished, that meant that the plane hits had to be guaranteed up front. And how are you going to guarantee that with a bunch of, you know, amateurs? Muhammad Atta was a psychopath. If you've ever read the book called Welcome to Terrorland, which I recommend, it's a very careful study of Muhammad Atta and his compatriots in Florida. And the author interviews many people who knew Atta and his Al-Qaeda friends down there. We're talking about people who worked at sub shops and car rental agencies, just ordinary people. And the author backs it up with video footage. It's not just what he writes in his book. He shows you the actual video footage. But Atta's girlfriend down in Florida, who was a pink-haired stripper, when she broke up with him, he went to her apartment and he took her cat and its kittens and cut it up into small pieces. This guy was a psychopath. He was a psychopath. He was also a heavy drug user. He was a cocaine snorter and a heavy drinker. And if you're going to plan the most important intelligence mission of the century, are you going to trust the mission to a psychotic who's a drug addict? I don't think you are. You might, I suppose, but I just don't think you are. But this is one of the things that really bothers me, is that the experienced Boeing pilots, I'll give you one quote and then I'll complete my take on this. This is from Captain Russ Wittenberger, former U.S. Air Force fighter pilot with over 100 combat missions. He flew for Pan Am and United Airlines for over 35 years. And here's what he had to say, quote, "I flew the actual aircraft which were involved in 9/11, flight number 175 and flight 93. The 757 that allegedly went down in Shanksville on the flight 175 that is alleged to hit the South Tower. I don't believe it's possible for a terrorist to train on a Cessna 172, then jump into the cockpit of a 757, 767 class cockpit, and vertical navigate the aircraft, lateral navigate the aircraft, and fly the airplane at speeds exceeding its design limit by well over 100 knots. Making high-speed bank turns, pulling 5, 6, 7 Gs. I could not do it, and I'm absolutely sure they could not do it." So that's coming from a guy, a pilot, who actually flew the planes that were used on 9/11. So I'm just pointing this out. I'm not saying it's impossible that the hijackers did it, but it's extremely suspect that every pilot made a perfect bullseye hit at these extreme speeds.
Yeah, it also would be one thing if the perpetrators, supposedly of the government narrative, 9/11, of the 19 hijackers, if they were really great pilots that had been trained and were professional. That's not the case. You find over and over again, as people had come into contact with whoever these people were, that they were incompetent. On right. many levels when it came to flight. And so, you know, you fast forward, you look at the whatever struck the Pentagon, and of course one of the most heavily surveilled videotaped buildings in the world, and all we have is that little sliver of a security cam where it shows something at ground level going really fast and then exploding. That's the only, as far as I know, is the only public image that's ever been released. So no, I mean, that's a great point. You know, if you're bringing up the impossibility of actually pulling that off with the And of course, you look at the BBC article, Hijackers Alive and Well, that came out shortly after 9/11. And we don't know who these people are. And so that's really good information, James. What do you got next?
The final point that I wanted to make was the failure of the Air Force to respond to the hijackings. Now, one of the things I was doing when I was researching my 9/11 book, I joined a group of professionals, and I don't count myself as a professional, but they allowed me in because I'm a writer of several books. And this included a former air traffic controller, a former Boeing captain, a former Boeing engineer, and physicists and other professionals with expertise relevant to 9/11. And one of the things that really struck me was the failure of the Air Force to respond. Now, the air traffic controller told us, and this has been confirmed to me by other air traffic controllers, that it was standard procedure that when an airplane went out of control, you automatically notify the NORAD and the Air Force. And if you look at the planes on 9/11, all four of them had three things happen. Number one, they turned off their designated course, wildly off the course. Number two, air traffic control lost all contact with the cockpit. And number three, they turned off their transponders, although Flight 175 turned it off momentarily, then turned it back on with a different number, which was kind of clever, according to some analysts. But the thing is that if you're an air traffic controller, you don't have to wait for the hijackers to call in and say, we've hijacked your aircraft. If you can't reach the cockpit and that plane is out of control, you automatically notify NORAD in the Air Force. And yet Flight 77, which is alleged to have hit the Pentagon, was allowed to fly for 44 minutes after hijack. And at no time was the Air Force or NORAD notified. At no time did any fighters come near it. I'm smiling because actually a couple of fighter planes did come close to Flight 77, but they had no idea that it was hijacked, so they didn't do a thing. We've got this problem, and I'm going to give you some information that I think a lot of your viewers and listeners probably don't know. And this comes from Nelson Garabito, who was head of the Secret Service at the White House on 9/11. And he said this in an interview with the mainstream media. I hope it's still up on YouTube. I haven't rechecked to see if it is. But he told the mainstream media that we knew we had two hijacked aircraft coming into Washington. One was 30 minutes out and one was 45 minutes out. Now, the one 30 minutes out is a reference to Flight 77, which hit the Pentagon. And one 45 minutes out is a reference to Flight 93, which is said to have crashed in Pennsylvania. Now, for confirmation of this, if we look at the 9/11 commission hearings, we have an interview with Terry Van Steenbergen, who was the FAA official in charge of Washington airspace. And he recalls a conversation he had on 9/11 with Nelson Garabito, head of the Secret Service. He says that Garabito told him that we have two hijacked aircraft coming into Washington. One is 30 minutes out. One is 45 minutes out. And he indicated that the Vice President, Dick Cheney, who was in charge down in the bunker, knew about this. Now, this is very serious information because no fighter planes were deployed to intercept these aircraft. According to the head of the Secret Service, who says he told Dick Cheney about this, we had two hijacked aircraft planes coming into Washington airspace. We had at least 30 minutes notice. Now, bear in mind that Andrews Air Force Base is only 8 miles from the Pentagon. And according to Andrews Air Force, I'm sorry, 10 miles from the Pentagon, according to its own online statement, it said, quote, the highest state of combat readiness. That's how it described itself. So according to Andrews Air Force Base, it is ready to go at any time in any combat situation. And I should mention that Daniel Kane, who was supervisor of flying at Andrews Air Force Base, called the Secret Service and said, do you need our help? And he was told, no, we don't need your help. And I'm sure you're familiar with the conversation of Norm Mineta, who was in the bunker with Dick Cheney. He was the Secretary of Transportation. And I'll give you his exact quote. He said, quote, there was a young man who had come in and said to the vice president, the plane is 50 miles out. The plane is 30 miles out. When it got down to the plane is 10 miles out, the young man also said to the vice president, do the orders still stand? And the vice president turned around and whipped his neck around and said, of course, the orders still stand. Have you heard anything to the contrary? End quote. That's an exact quote from our Secretary of Transportation. So Dick Cheney knew these planes were coming in, as just as Nelson Garabito, the head of the Secret Service, said. Yet he did nothing. He ordered no planes deployed, no fighter planes took off from Andrews Air Force Base. It was not until after the Pentagon was hit that Dick Cheney finally gave permission for Andrews Air Force Base to deploy fighters. But at that point, it's too late, because by the time those planes were up in the air, Flight 93 had already crashed, or was alleged to have crashed in Pennsylvania. So as far as Dick Cheney's orders being to intercept these planes, I don't know what planes he's referring to, because he'd not given any orders to any planes to intercept them. All fighter planes were still on the ground. However, I'm going to try to be as fair as I can to Dick Cheney. And I'm just going to mention that earlier, before Nelson Garabito made this statement, there were three fighter planes deployed from Langley Air Force Base, but they were not sent to intercept Flight 77 or 93, nor were they sent to defend Washington, D.C. Instead, they were sent out over the Atlantic Ocean due to a false report that Flight 11 had not hit the World Trade Center, but was still airborne and heading south. And that's why they were sent over the Atlantic. I personally think, I don't have proof of this, I personally think this is where there was electronic, some people said that 9/11 was a computer crime. I believe they had methods of putting false blips on computer screens, and that these three fighter planes from Langley were deked out, were faked out, and they went out over the Atlantic thinking that they were going to intercept a plane when they were not. And this got them well out of the way of Flight 77, which hit the Pentagon. Now, eventually, when they realized they'd been faked out, they did start heading back into Washington, but well too late to stop the destruction on the Pentagon. Now, you could always say that Dick Cheney was saying, the orders still stand. If these fighter planes get back from the Atlantic, then they can try to intercept the plane that's coming in towards the Pentagon or towards Washington, D.C. That is to give Dick Cheney the greatest amount of lenience. But if in fact that is true, why didn't he deploy any fighters from Andrews Air Force Base or any other Air Force Base? Why did he simply rely on these three fighter planes that were out over the Atlantic?
That's kind to Dick Cheney.
That's as kind as I can be to him. But the point is that the United States Air Force and NORAD allowed Flight 77 to fly for 44 minutes after hijack. No attempt whatsoever to lift a plane off, totally contrary to protocols that had existed prior to that, according to the air traffic controllers that I've talked to, who said that the moment a plane goes out of control, you automatically put the Air Force into the sky. And that did not happen on 9/11. It's pretty obvious to me that Dick Cheney and his neocon comrades in the Pentagon wanted to make sure that the missions were carried out successfully. Once the Pentagon was hit, that kind of sealed the deal, and they could now proceed with endless wars in the Middle East, making sure that they never captured bin Laden. And we can talk about that as well. They made sure that they never captured bin Laden in order to make absolutely sure that these wars continued on. But for me, these four areas of evidence, the collapse, the anomalous collapse of the Twin Towers, the Annapolis anomalous collapse of Building 7, the incredible speed and accuracy of the hijacker hits on 9/11, and the complete failure of NORAD and the Air Force to respond in a way that would have been normal on 9/11, all indicate that the government story is false. There's a much more detail we could get into in my book, which I would have. But I wanted to cover these four points because I think that for people who are new to 9/11, these may help to open some eyes.
No, I thought that was brilliant. I mean, it's a really good place to start. And of course, as you were talking about Dick Cheney, I was thinking, you know, the shades of Pearl Harbor, the project for the new American century, notwithstanding. But you have this let it happen on purpose. And in my opinion, that's what we're witnessing on 9/11. But there has to be sophisticated collusion between higher entities. It isn't just terrorism, and it isn't just an inside job. There seems to me there's a larger network at play. We've only got about 4 minutes left, but anybody that follows you, James, on your Twitter account knows that you also look at outside state sponsored interference in 9/11. Talk a little bit with the 4 minutes we have left. I know I'm putting you on the spot, but talk a little bit about another event on 9/11, the Dancing Israelis. I know you've done some research on that.
Israel appears to have acted in collusion with the neocons in the Pentagon. And all you have to do is just look at the people who are in the Pentagon, like Douglas Feith, who received a special Zionist award, and Paul Wolfowitz, who gave a speech at a place called Stand First with Israel and actually lived in Israel as a teenager. He was the assistant secretary of defense. He's along with the PNAC is one who actually at the graduating class of West Point in 2001 warned them of a new Pearl Harbor. There were actually several warnings of a new Pearl Harbor. It wasn't just PNAC. It was all coming from the same group of people in the Pentagon. Now, the Dancing Israelis were Israelis who were actually seeing, celebrating, and high-fiving the 9/11 attacks. They took off in a white van. Neighbors reported them, and it was on CNN that day. I remember it. And then the story just absolutely vanished from the news. I think Fox did pick it up, but the rest of the network simply dropped it. And the Israelis were allowed to return to Israel on immigration charges. But they should have been. The fact that they were photographing the 9/11 event and they were celebrating it should have been enough to send them down to Gitmo and torture them. I'm sorry, I don't know if they advocate torture, but they should have been made to talk and forced to tell what exactly they knew. I should mention that they worked for a company called Urban Moving Systems. And the head of Urban Moving Systems, Derek Souter, closed Urban Moving Systems on the day of 9/11. And then as soon as flights were allowed, he fled back to Israel. He did not want to be questioned by the FBI. He didn't, you know, there was so much Israeli involvement on 9/11. And if I give you a quick quote, if we have time, this is from Dr. Alan Zabrowski, who retired Marine officer and former director of studies at the United States Army War College Strategic Studies Institute, said, quote, "I have had long conversations over the past 2 weeks with contacts at the Army War College at the headquarters of the Marine Corps, and have made it absolutely clear in both cases that it is 100% certain that 9/11 was a Mossad operation," end quote. And one of the things I've tweeted out today is an interview with Mohammed Atta's father, who says that 9/11 was a Mossad operation. And he says that he was called by his son, Mohammed Atta, after 9/11. Whether or not we know that's true or not, we don't. But he definitely did say that 9/11 was a Mossad operation. And there's so much evidence that points to that. Israel was the beneficiary. You know, Islamic countries did not benefit from 9/11. We bombed the heck out of them. We made war on them. America didn't benefit. We got the TSA and we got, you know, the Patriot Act and all kinds of impositions on our liberties. The only real beneficiary for 9/11 was Israel. And, of course, Benjamin Netanyahu involved throughout that. I should mention that Benjamin Netanyahu was good friends with Larry Silverstein, who had taken control of the World Trade Center just 6 weeks before the event happened. And according to newspaper,
we're coming up on the end of the show, James. I've got to cut the show off, and I'm so sorry. We got so much left to talk about. Folks, thanks for joining us. James Perloff, jamesperloff.net. Go find his work, buy his books. End of transmission.